With Amazon ads continually increasing in price, what is going to be your competitive edge? At Samurai Seller, we've created a software that helps you take control of your Amazon ads, not just with ad tools, but tools for analytics into your business and your profitability to make sure that you're always increasing in sales and in profit. Try it for an entire month for free on me. SamuraiSeller.com/start and get a free month of the cutting edge Samurai Seller software for Amazon performance. Hey, if you've been on Amazon, you have success, it must have come into your mind to see how much is my business worth? How much could I sell it for today? If you want to get a valuation from us, we know what is very valuable in Amazon companies. Go to AaronCordovez.com/valuation and we will tell you what we would buy it for. And if we put an offer, we close. We will close cash up front and a huge back end for you to get money as the brand continues to grow. AaronCordovez.com/valuation.
This is the Aaron Cordovez Show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. And today I have Nathan Hirsch on the podcast, who is a guru. Well, I mean, I don't know, guys. Guru is like a dirty word now, but basically a guy who's extremely knowledgeable, not just in e-commerce, but hiring virtual assistants, doing your books, keeping track of your numbers. Overall, just a guy who's getting out there and helping people with their e-commerce business and non-e-commerce businesses. So, Nathan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I don't know if I've ever been called a guru. I don't know how I feel about that, but I appreciate you having me.
I know, that's what I'm saying, man. I mean, I don't know. Isn't there that one show, like, I think the title's like, I Am Your Guru? It's like, come on. It's kind of cheesy and whatever, but at the end of the day, right, dictionary definition, I believe it's just a person who's knowledgeable on something. So, I mean, I don't know. We get so offended nowadays, right? So, I don't know. People call me, I was actually kicked out of a group because I was a guru one time. Like, I'm too guru-ish, but I'm like, okay, whatever, dude. I don't know. I don't have a beard, and I'm not doing, like, yoga. I think those are the original gurus, something like that.
Right, exactly.
Anyway, so I'll tell you something. I want to just start off with asking you about, like, why books? And I have my answer, right? Like, why bookkeeping? Because in e-commerce, I was not doing a monthly P&L, and we did almost go bankrupt, like, about 2 years into the company simply because I had no idea what the hell I was doing. I had no software keeping track of books, and I almost went bankrupt. So anyway, I understand this is a very hot topic and very important for people to really understand, but why, you know, do you focus your entire business on this topic?
Yeah, I mean, going back to my Amazon days, I mean, I was running a multi-million dollar Amazon business out of my college frat house when I was 20, and I had no idea what I was doing as an entrepreneur. And so I tried doing bookkeeping myself. That was a disaster. I had no idea what I was doing. I started hiring college kids to do my bookkeeping. That went just as poorly. Then I would dump the books on my CPA at the end of the year. Then I tried to hire a bookkeeper quarterly. And then finally I realized, hey, I need to be getting books every single month that actually make good decisions for my business. So one of the best decisions that Connor, my partner, and I ever made was hiring a bookkeeper from day one of FreeUp, before we were profitable, before we had that many clients. And every single month we would get a report that said how we were doing, what services were performing well, where our margins going up and down, and we would make good decisions to help us grow. And when we went to sell the company and pass due diligence, we had 4 years of immaculate books going back to day one. So that really helped us. And the real story is we sold FreeUp in 2019, November 2019. So the original plan was we were going to take a year off, travel the world. I didn't think I'd see my business partner. COVID hit a few months later, and we were kind of in a weird spot. We had nothing to work on and stuck at home like everyone else. So we started brainstorming different business ideas, and we like boring, unsexy businesses that apply to every business out there if possible. And we knew kind of what we went through with our Amazon business and how it helped us with FreeUp. So that kind of gave us the idea to start our own monthly bookkeeping service.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what about your Amazon business? Is that you didn't sell that? That just kind of fizzled out slowly. Like I'm curious because I mean, you guys were selling quite a bit. You know, you have, you know, over tens of millions of dollars sold. And so, how did that go? Because that's what, you know, my podcast is typically about that. And there's a lot of stories where people make a bunch of money and then they'll pivot. So, how did that pivot occur for you?
Yeah, so we were doing drop shipping before we even knew it was called drop shipping. It wasn't until years into the business that we even heard the word drop shipping. And this was back before a lot of retailers, a lot of manufacturers even knew what Amazon was. So we went to all these manufacturers and we said, hey, I got this other sales channel for you. I'm good at selling products on Amazon. All you got to do is keep my credit card on file, ship stuff where I tell you to ship it. I'll mark it up and make my margin. And that was a relationship that I built with hundreds of U.S. manufacturers, including some big ones like Step 2, before they realized they could just go on Amazon themselves. So we sold $25 million over like a 7-year period, but we peaked out at about $5 million, $6 million a year. And at the beginning, we're like, oh, we're going to take down Amazon. We're going to be this next e-commerce giant. And then you start seeing algorithm changes and new sellers coming up and courses and all the stuff. So then you're kind of fluctuating. You have a year where you're doing 3 million, then 2, then back to 3. And we're selling other people's products. We're never really doing private labels. So we kind of saw the writing on the wall that like, hey, this was a great cash cow, but it's probably not sustainable. But we had all these VAs and freelancers that we had hired because college kids were super unreliable. And we started offering them to other e-commerce sellers. And that was a lot of fun. It was our first B2B business. We got to learn marketing and SEO and podcasts. And that kind of took off and surpassed our Amazon sales. So about year one and a half of FreeUp, we decided to shut down the Amazon business and focus on FreeUp. And that was one of our better decisions.
Oh, beautiful. That's really cool. And I want to take it back to something you said. You said like college kids, right, are not very reliable. And of course, I mean, that's like a general statement. I'm sure there are some who are extremely reliable, but probably large and main, maybe they're not, right? Because they're focusing on something else. But what has been your experience like hiring? How many did you hire and how did that go? And then why do you think that is?
So keep in mind, there was very little Amazon software back then. So everything was manual. Repricing was manual, updating inventory, all of that. So we hire one of my first hires back when, actually, let me back it up. I'm making a lot of money. I'm running this Amazon business by myself. And I meet with an accountant because my parents tell me I should probably pay taxes. And he says, hey, when are you going to hire your first person? And I kind of say like, why would I hire someone? Like it's money out of my pocket. They're going to steal my ideas. They're going to hurt my business. Like all your standard entrepreneurial excuses. And my accountant just laughed in my face and said, you're going to figure this out on your own. So I get to my first busy season and I just get destroyed. I'm not prepared. I'm doing everything myself. I'm working 20 hours a day trying to fulfill all these dropshipping orders. And I burn myself out. My grades plummet. My social life is gone. I get to January. I'm like, all right, that
was
a disaster.
You're in college yourself at this point. Your grades plummeting. You're in college yourself.
Yeah, I was a sophomore in college.
Okay.
So I post a job on Facebook. And this guy in my business law class says, I don't know what you do, but I need a job. And I didn't even interview him. I hired him on the spot. And that ended up being my longtime business partner, Connor. I just got super lucky. So there I am thinking like this hiring thing's easy. You post a job, people show up, they make your life easier. And then I just make bad hire after bad hire after bad hire. Like people who are smoking weed and drinking on the job, people where I have to run to their dorm room and like smash on their door to get them to wake up and come to work. And that's where I kind of got into the VA game because a buddy of mine was running a photography business and he was using VAs and he introduced me to VAs in the Philippines. So yeah, I mean, to answer your question, it's just not their number one priority. That's why I'm always against like hiring interns or college kids, unless it's that role. But a lot of people try to do that and then they invest a lot of time and energy and training into them and it ends up not being a long-term thing. And you're wasting a lot of money when you can just hire a VA who hopefully is with you for years to come.
Nice. Yeah, and we've had people, you know, and VA I think is a term, one of those terms where I don't know if I really understand the term because virtual assistant. I mean, they're not virtual; they're real people, right? Like the VA, like for me, I'm like the VA. I imagine like a person inside of some sort of computer, right? Like I am your like Siri, right? Like Siri's a virtual assistant. Anyway, whatever, it's fine. It's just a name. But we've had people who, you know, let's say over in the Philippines, over in Venezuela, who have been with us for. Since the beginning, you know, 5 years, 6 years, and fantastic people. And again, just like here in the U.S., you find some that are phenomenal and some that stay with us for a month or two and we have to let them go, right? Just like, you know, hiring in college, right? But I do think that them being already in a later phase in their life where they're ready for a career and they're working with a, you know, a US-based company, which I believe that's a huge opportunity, right? I know we pay a lot better than 99% of Venezuelan companies.
Absolutely. And our key is we get them to really buy into the company and love the company. And I mean, the people we hired in the first month of FreeUp were still with us for the, till the end. And they're still with FreeUp now. I mean, we took care of them. We took $500,000 from the sale and gave it to our team in the Philippines and made sure their jobs are secure and all of that. But like, we look for really loyal people who, like, if we're going to invest time and energy into someone, we want them to be with us long term, and turnover just crushes businesses. So we want to become their favorite client. We want to create a win for them, a win for us, and hopefully keep them around for as long as humanly possible.
Nice, nice. And so one of the, I know we're just talking about outsourcing here, but I heard this concept in this conference I was just at, which is the first time I'd heard of it. And maybe you teach something about this in outsourcing school, but he's saying that he doesn't bring on people full time. Because that's what I do normally. You know, I go to like, I don't really use like a FreeUp where it's more transactional, I think, or maybe it's not. But anyway, it's not, you know, it's not your main company now. But I go like onlinejobs.ph or rabota.ru, you know, different websites who you just hire the people directly. But I heard this concept of hiring sort of employees or remote workers, but in flux, right? So in the busy season, you'll have some people, and then if you don't need them, they're not there. And if you hire them by a task basis, well, then your salaries are much lower. Anyway, I don't know. I always thought that wasn't like a smart idea, but at the end of the day, it's your choice, right? If you want it, you want them long-term and have them always on salary because you're always paying that, or you want it more in flux and you're going to save a little bit on the payroll, but now you have people who are possibly more motivated because they're more working on the jobs. I don't know. What's your take on the full-time versus sort of in flux, like seasonal kind of task working?
Yeah, I would respectfully disagree with that. If I'm hiring a VA, well, keep in mind, there's three different types of people you can hire. You got the followers, which are the VAs, you got the doers, which are the freelancers, and then you got the experts, coaches, consultants, agencies. So the doers and the experts, task-based, project-based, monthly retainer, like all those are options because you're not training those people. But if I'm training a follower, and I want them to be full-time and exclusive to me, and you run into a lot of issues when you hire someone part-time. Like there are situations where people would hire someone on FreeUp for 10 hours a week and they'd really like the VA. Well, that VA can't survive on 10 hours a week. So they're going to go out and get a few other clients. And then that original client wants to increase the hours and the VA can't do that. And then you're in a tough spot. There's ways you can get around it. Like we've had situations where we gave someone a raise, an agreement to drop the other client and stuff like that. But that's not a guarantee. So for me, I want 100% of their focus on my business. I want to make sure that if I like someone, I can get all their hours. And I want to make sure that they're with me long term. And you're just adding a lot of risk if you're only giving them task-based or hourly. And who knows, their other client might be doing the same thing. The other client might like that VA and say, hey, I want to hire you full time. And then you lose someone and then you have to cover replacement costs and all of that. So I'm a big proponent that if you can, and there's obviously people out there that can only afford 5 hours a week or whatever, but hire full-time from the beginning, exclusive to you, and make sure that they're really a part of your company. And you're going to thank yourself down the line if you do that.
Yeah, I know. And trust me, that's what I do almost all of the time, right? And now you mentioned this categories. That's like, I don't know, you know, the follower category as you describe, right? Which is a person who's going to be in your company. They're going to be full-time. They're going to be for you. And you have to train them. And then you said you have this freelancer, which is they typically work on task, right? That's kind of the only way you can hire them unless you convince them to do otherwise. Is that what that kind of freelancer category is, like kind of the Fiverr.com kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the way that we set it up, if you build a really good Rolodex of freelancers you can rely on, graphic designers, web editors, writers, you can use them from business to business. Like every time I need a blog article written or a graphic design project done, I don't want to post a job and start interviewing people. I want to have a reliable group of people that I can go to. And if one of my graphic designers busy, I can go to the second one there. So that's the way that I would set it up as an entrepreneur, like solely build up this Rolodex of reliable doers that you can go to for different projects. And as you build companies, you can kind of pull them in as needed. And unless you're running like a video editing agency and you need full-time video editors, most of the time they're not full-time and you're just hiring them as on a task-by-task basis.
Okay. And then agency, of course, is like if you need some specialists, you have no idea what to do when you hire some sort of agency, right? That's the other bucket, like retainers or lawyers or something like that. Is that
Yeah, it could be a consultant. I mean, they're coming in with, yeah, they're coming in with their own systems, their own processes that they've had success with in the past, and they're implementing them in your business. It can be a collaboration just depending on how they work, but you're not teaching them how to do something. They're coming in. And I mean, the way to think about it too is, as an entrepreneur, you can't take a course on everything. Like, at some point, you can't try to master every single skill. You got to bring in an expert that already has that skill and implement that in your business.
Right, right. Okay, good, good. And now, let's talk about books for a little bit, right? So, you knew nothing about bookkeeping, accounting. You didn't go to school for this stuff, but you had to learn it. Like, everybody has to learn. Like, that's something that every business owner should know, because there are terrible bookkeepers out there, right? So, what was your path to learning? Did you take, like, bookkeeping courses? Did you, like, just read your P&L a million times? Did you check YouTube? Like, how did you become knowledgeable in this space?
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that you should not take a course on how to use QuickBooks. You don't even have to log into QuickBooks. You shouldn't learn how to reconcile an account. You do have to learn how to read an income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow. And yes, there's plenty of YouTube videos. I'm sure I've watched a bunch. I took Accounting 101 in college. But the real way you learn it, like you mentioned, is by going through your books every single month. You should have a monthly meeting on your calendar every single month that you don't miss for any reason. Your bookkeeper gets you your books on time, hopefully, and you go through your books line by line. You ask questions, you make sure you understand your numbers. If anyone wants my monthly agenda, you can go to econbalance.com/agenda. It's the same meeting that Connor and I have been running for 6 years. And that's how you're going to really get to understand your numbers. You're going to really get to understand these reports, and it's going to help you in ways you don't even think about. Like, when we went through due diligence and we had an initial call with the buyers, they asked us a lot of questions about our finances. And because we had done this meeting every single month for 4 years, we knew our numbers inside and out. And then when they actually got into the numbers, it matched everything we said on the phone call. And if it didn't, that's a quick turnoff right away. So that you have to learn how to read those three reports. It's going to help you with your own business. If you invest in businesses, I'm assuming you invest in the stock market, like, you should be reading P&Ls and balance sheets of the stocks that you invest in. So, yeah, you don't invest in the stock market. Well, for people listening that do, like, it's a good life skill to have.
I invest in the stock market. No, man, I think it's too risky, right? Even if you're looking at a balance sheet, there's so much insider data you don't have, right? I'd rather invest in the companies, right? Like, I'd rather go in and, let's say it was FreeUp. Like, I'd rather be the person buying FreeUp, because now you take it over, you can control it, and you can move it forward in the direction you have. Now, I would never buy a e-commerce freelance agency, because I don't know how to do that. But we buy Amazon companies, right? We have a company called Nexus Capital, nexuscap.com, and we actually just buy companies. Right, Amazon companies, Amazon brands we've acquired. I'm not even going to say, because if I don't give the right number, and then there's filings and whatever. But the point is, we bought several companies. We have, I don't know, seven brands plus, actually seven accounts, more brands than that, because like one account might have five brands. But anyway,
but that situation, you got to read those.
You need to do
the
due diligence on the book.
Right, exactly. Yes.
That's correct. You know, that balance sheet, the P&L is huge, and you encounter a lot of times people making, you know, mistakes, or maybe things on no joke. We had one. We were in, hold on, let me tell you the story, because this is crazy, and it goes into, people are doing some shady stuff. So there was a company we're looking to buy, and they had whatever revenue it was, I don't know, 3 million, 4 million, whatever it was. And when we imported the books, right, they gave us their P&L, but we said, hey, we have to build this P&L again from scratch. We have to take all the Amazon reports and connect it, and we sort of rebuilt it. And we found out that they had two different softwares importing their Amazon sales. So their revenue was half of what they had reported. Okay. And let's say the purchase price was, I don't know, 3 or 4 million, whatever it was. And we said, well, your profit's not, you know, a million. It's now like actually only 500,000. So we'll give you the same offer, the same multiple, but your revenue is half. And they said, really? So they checked it out, and they came back like a week later, and they said, oh, you're right. Like, we were double counting the income. However, we still want the original offer, right? The original purchase price. You guys are absolutely psychotic, right? You've just shown to me that you're totally untrustworthy and you don't want to adjust the price. So you're essentially telling me you wanted to sell this company based on an entire lie. And they're like, yeah, we still want the $4 million. We won't change it. No, right. So anyway, we walked away from that deal. But I believe there are people who go into due diligence, do not recreate the books, do not understand, and actually pay double. And those guys, that's why they're doing that, and they want the same price, because they're going to do that over and over and over, knowing their books are wrong, trying to get that inflated price, because there are people who have purchased companies with fake books. That does happen, right? Have you seen anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we'll get requests from some of our clients, and they're not necessarily, they're well-intentioned, but essentially to remove stuff off of the books before going through a sale. And we obviously tell them, hey, you can't do that, stuff like that. I mean, from our side, like, we tried to be upfront and honest. And I think you, like, part of going through a deal is building trust with the buyer. I'm friends with a lot of people that buy companies like you, and that's the number one red flag, is if the buyer tells them one thing and they get in the books and they see something completely different, like, why would you want to work with that person, buy a business from that person? That's a recipe for disaster. And when we were going through the sale, like, we wanted to sell to really good people that were going to honor their word and have the same values as us. And we were going to be upfront and honest, and we wanted people that were going to do the same. And we don't want to end up in a lawsuit down the line or arguing with them for years to come. So kind of goes both ways there.
Yeah. You want to know, like, if they're lying about this, and what else are they lying about, right? What else is going on there? For sure. That's a pretty bad one. So what about people taking, you know, their own salaries? And let's talk about some of these things that people, I don't know if everybody understands it, to be honest. Actually, before we get that, how much do you think an average business owner, let's see, what's your average kind of client size? And how many people are you guys working with, approximately, if you can't get into, you know, more?
Yeah, we have over 100 clients. Most of them are in that 500,000 to 3 million mark. We've got some people smaller, usually the veteran entrepreneurs who, like me, know, hey, when you start a business, you hire a bookkeeper from day one, just because it's a necessary business expense. And then we've got some eight-figure people as well. But I would say normally they're in that 500,000 to 3 million. And okay. Just so we're on the same page, I am not a bookkeeper. I'm not a CPA. I don't pretend to be one. We have a great bookkeeping team that handles it. I'm an entrepreneur. I build businesses that support other entrepreneurs. So if we're going to dive into, like, specific tax questions or like bookkeeping questions, I'm probably not the one to answer them.
No advice. No tax advice. No, but what have you seen? And you're probably talking to the clients, right, on that marketing side or the closing of the deals. Like, what do you see is the biggest downfall of people with their books, with their finances, right? What is the thing that they're missing? That you've seen, like, the number one thing, let's say, hey, someone's listening to this out of $500,000 million revenue, and you're like, hey, you need to do bookkeeping because you're going to find out this thing, or you're making this mistake. What are those big errors?
Yeah, I got a few of them. But also keep in mind, it's not like I'm reviewing our clients' books. Like, usually I never look at our clients' books. I'm just the one running the company. But I mean, the biggest thing with e-commerce, when you're connecting from, like, QuickBooks to Amazon, you need that connecting tool, like A2X, ConnectBooks, Link My Book, stuff like that. Because a lot of bookkeepers that don't understand e-commerce, they'll just take the net that's deposited into the client's bank account and put that as a top line of the income statement, which is obviously incorrect. You've got different Amazon fees, refunds, returns, stuff like that in the breakdown. So that's one thing. I think a lot of people don't segment their books correctly. They might be selling five products and two of them are unprofitable and they have no idea because it's all lumped together in one thing. So that's a big thing we try to preach to our clients. Make sure you know how you're doing on Shopify compared to Amazon. Like, you'll get people who are selling on Amazon Europe and they're wasting a lot of time and energy and making barely any money on it, but they have no idea. And they're just doing it because someone told them they should probably be selling on Amazon Europe. So making sure that they're focusing their time in the right place. And then cash flow is king. Like, there's a lot of e-commerce companies that go out of business, not because they're unprofitable, just because they run out of cash. So making sure that you're not just the entrepreneur that's looking at the P&L, but you're looking at the balance sheet and the cash flow statement as well. To me, that's key. And I think a lot of e-commerce people overlook that.
And how do you, so we do, by the way, for us, for our cash flow, I don't do the cash flow in QuickBooks. We have, like, an Excel sheet. Actually, I have a download, AaronCordova.com/, what is it? It's like, I don't know, I forgot, like a download, cash flow maybe. I'll just say it's cash flow. So in this grid, we have it like biweekly, every time there's a deposit, and we have that deposit come in and we have all our expenses and we import our the bank statement and all the expenses and they get categorized. And it's all done in Excel, and now manually. Now realistically, I've thought about checking some software someplace, but I don't think QuickBooks does that very well, and to see where your cash is going to be in a certain point in the future. Do you guys know, like, do you do something like that yourself, some sort of cash flow report? How do you control this, or you don't really have a good
No, I mean, we don't do, we only do monthly bookkeeping, charge you on the first, books by the 15th, income statement, balance sheet, cash flow. When it gets into forecasting, whether it's forecasting cash, forecasting sales, there's a lot of like fractional CFO services that do that. That's where it kind of bleeds into, and that's what you recommend. I mean, you can, depending on the size of your business, you might be able to do it on Excel. I have some clients who have some pretty easy formulas that project out cash 15, 16 weeks, stuff like that. And as you get bigger and the more places you sell on, it becomes harder to do. So, I mean, there are services out there. I don't know any like tools off the top of my head that necessarily do it. But I, for the most part, like people are hiring those fractional or outsourced CFOs to project stuff into the future.
Okay. Okay, good. So fine. But monthly bookkeeping. So, I mean, I like the topic and margins. What about margins? Look, one of my most, I guess, seen posts of all time was when I went into an example of an Amazon business and I said, listen, the margins, you're doing everything. You're down to, let's say, 7.5% profit, which the other day I talked to a top 100 seller and their margin is more like 6%, 5%. They're could be very low, right? And the high margins, you know, high considering, let's say, 20%, 25%, they're very, very far and few in between from what I've seen. What have you seen in terms of margins? Again, I know you're not looking in the books, right? Maybe you have no idea and you can't answer the question. I should not ask more book questions. If you don't have the answer to this, I will stop asking books questions. But what do you see this typical margin is for an Amazon private label seller?
No, I mean, you're right. Like back when I was selling, we were hitting 20, 25% margins and it was incredible. I think that's pretty rare. I think you do have those people that are in the 6 to 10. I think the people who do it right and are really on top of it are on that 10 to 15. But the one thing that I think every seller should be doing is you should be comparing this month to last month and this month to the same month last year with your margins. Like you want to be seeing trends. Like are you going the right direction or the wrong direction? And if you're going the wrong direction, you need to go line by line. And it could be more on like the actual selling product side, like your shipping, your inventory, stuff like that. And there's other ways just overall margin, like do you really need to increase payroll? Can you automate anything there? Do you have software expenses that you can pay yearly and save money on or cut in general? Like those are the kinds of decisions you should be making at the monthly agenda. But I mean, margins is one thing that with FreeUp, we were super on top of. If we had a month where margins were going in the wrong direction, we're creating a plan, we're making tweaks, we're making adjustments. And it's the same thing for sellers.
Nice, nice, brilliant, brilliant. And that's what I've seen again too. 10 to 15, you're pretty golden. And honestly, in business, that's considered high margin. Like
for an e-commerce business. Restaurants too. It depends on the industry. Yeah.
It depends on the industry, but like typically, that's not bad. 15%. I mean, I don't know if you've seen, you talked about the stock market and public reports, but you see companies, again, like Macy's, and they had a bankruptcy, right? But they had, you know, first quarter, second quarter, third quarter were like between 1% and 1% negative. And then in the fourth quarter, they made like 3%. And that was their year. Man, that is some scary stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of companies operate that way in these single-digit margins. And I go, listen, if you're at 15% in Amazon, like, you are so strong. And anyway, like you said, what's the trend going? And, hey, I'd rather have a 10% margin business at $200 million than a 30% margin business at $5 million. You know what I mean? So you can't pay your bills with a percent margin. That's what I always tell people too. It's like, stop being so like short-sighted and know that if you're growing, you have a margin that you're not, your cash flow is under control. You're fine, right? And then if you want to control it, like you said, do it. But at the same time, 9% at a bigger business is better than 10% in a smaller business. I mean, that's another thing that I always look at is, are you growing
and segmentation,
or are you shrinking,
too,
not just
like
in percentage?
Your Shopify compared to Amazon, stuff like that.
Yes. That is
cool. And
that is
like cool. Products, like you might have one product where you have a great margin and one product where you don't. So those are all just things to consider. Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off. Keep going.
No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and discontinuing. Man, you know what I hate about liquidation discontinuing? If you have product that's taking up storage and you sell it, right, to save money in the future, it hits your books, right, and you have a net, you have a loss, and it looks like you did bad that month, but you just had to liquidate stuff. You kind of have these sitting unrealized losses. No, I think that's the term for it. But it really sucks. You know, we made a sale just last week, and it was, I don't know, 40,000, 50,000. and it was like negative $20,000 profit because we had to move product that we had never sold. And that's going to make this month look like, you know, less profitable than other months when that was always sitting there. It's not like we actually did anything this month. That's been a loss for the last 4 months. Now we're actually, it's actually good for the company, but it's showing out as a loss because that's when we sold it, you know? And so I think there's a lot of these unrealized losses in e-commerce where you have dead products, you have dead things, and you have to swallow that, bite the bullet and take the loss. But do you have any sort of recommendations in terms of doing that in a smart way?
Yeah, I mean, spreading it out can maybe help. Like, I kind of relate it to going through the sale, and I'm sure you've seen this too. Like, the best way is just be upfront and honest. Like, there was a month in FreeUp where we invested a lot in software. And so when we went through the sale, we're like, hey, look at this month. We're going to tell you about it upfront. We spent 20K, 30K in software. That affected the profit. But here's the IP we created. This was the result of it. And like, buyers are understand if you're upfront and honest about it. So I mean, that's like a normal thing that comes up in e-commerce, liquidating old inventory. If a certain loss has come up here and there, or not even losses, just larger expenses, and you're going through that sale, just be upfront and honest. Like, those things happen, they come up, they're to be expected. And the buyer can sometimes look at it as a positive because they might not have to go through that again if you've already done it, if you have already taken care of it. It's almost like conferences. Like, we had a big, I used to go to a lot of conferences. Now I'm retired from conferences. But the during FreeUp, like, we had all these conference expenses, and like, the new buyers didn't have to keep those expenses. Like, they could market in a different way that didn't involve conferences. So there's certain ways that you can kind of tweak those.
Those are all ad backs. You put those
exactly.
Ad backs, and there was.
So okay. That's what I'm
so, dude,
to say.
Tell me. I want to know because again, I'm not in the consulting business really in any strong way, but we are in buying companies, okay, and we have a fund, okay. So we closed our first fund a few months ago, and we're raising money because we're buying Amazon companies, primarily Amazon companies, with other people's money, and then we split the profit. Okay, that's generally how that works, and looking for new people who want to sell, looking for, you know, making connections, talking to people. How is conferences? I mean, you're retired from conferences now, but you went to a lot of them. How has conferences, how have they affected your business growth, your mindset, your connections? Like, talk to me about why are you retired from them? Weren't they so successful for you?
Yeah, conferences are great. I know, like, going to conferences was a big part of growing FreeUp. Me personally, I'm kind of at the point in my life where I only want to run businesses if they don't require me to go anywhere or like do anything like that. So that's kind of just my personal take on it. Like, I hustled for 4 years. It was totally worth it. It was life changing. Conferences, my cheat sheet for conferences as a service provider is I stopped about 2 years into FreeUp. I stopped sponsoring the booths. And the one thing to keep in mind is I ran a completely remote business. So if someone was sitting at the booth, it was me, which wasn't the most fun thing in the world. But what I would do instead is sponsor the VIP dinners and stuff afterwards. So I'd attend the conference, meet people, sponsor the VIP party. All the people that I wanted to talk to were at that party. My name was on the party. My company name was on the party. And then I would co-sponsor it with other service providers. So we'd kind of get their list and their network as well. So that was not only cheaper than the booths, but I also didn't have to sit at the booths for days. And I got to meet all the people at my sponsored party anyway. So that was kind of my cheat sheet. If anyone wants to steal it, I met a lot of great people there, and it's always good just connecting with people in the industry.
And you had fun. Did you have fun going to those things?
Yeah, I did. I want to run businesses that don't require me. Like, I'm happy to go on podcasts for 30 minutes a day. I'm happy to do strategic meetings and build a company, a team, and slowly fizzle my way out of it. But if the way that I get customers is going and traveling across the world and networking, like, that's not a sustainable channel. The second that I have to turn that off, customers stop coming in. So I want to build marketing channels that don't require Nathan Hirsch being in certain places at certain times.
Okay. And what's your ultimate goal with business? I mean, look, you have millions of dollars, right? You hear people saying all the time, oh, if I had that much money, like, I'd retire and I'd do nothing and sit on the beach. Like, what is driving you to continue pushing in the business and going on all these podcasts? I saw your list. It was massive. I mean, I don't know if I've ever spoken to somebody who's been on more podcasts than you. Like, you are hustling. why the hell are you hustling?
Yeah, I would argue that I'm not hustling. I don't go as many podcasts as I used to. Like before, I was going on like 3 to 5 a day back in the free up days. Oh. Now I do like one or two a week, which isn't that big of a deal. Yeah, I mean, we want to build a portfolio of companies. Like people say, oh, you're just going to like flip econ balance, accounts balance. Like I went through one exit. I don't know if I'm just like known for selling companies, but we want to build a portfolio of companies that help people that run without us. And we have Outsource School, we have econ balance, we have accounts balance. We have a few ideas for other ones to either start or buy. And we just want to continue building a really good portfolio. And I mean, I don't know if I'll ever just do nothing and sit on the beach. Like that doesn't seem much fun. Like I pretty much have time freedom. Like I can do whatever I want, whenever I want. Like my sister's wedding's coming up. My cousins are visiting. My wife's brother's coming in. Like I'm pretty much off for the next 2 to 3 weeks. So I'm able to kind of do that, but I like growing businesses. It's fun. I love being able to help people and being able to try different things, and some of them work and some of them don't. And you kind of learn from it. So I want to build a business where I don't have to work weekends. I don't have to work nights. I can cancel things when I don't want to do them. I can say no to a lot of stuff, but still kind of build this portfolio that Connor and I want to have. So
nice. Okay. So basically a lifestyle business, right? You do it on your own terms. So you're basically, it seems like you're, you know, you're almost semi-retired then. So you're not, you're saying, hey, you're specifically saying I'm not in hustle mode. I did the hustle mode. You're done. Do you think you're going to ever go back to that hustle mode sometime? I mean, you're young. You're, dude, you're super young. You're not even 30 yet, right? You're like in your 20s.
I know. I'm 34, but thanks for the compliment.
34, okay.
Yeah, I don't think I'm retired. I think that I just create businesses that allow me to work like schedules I want. Like I don't know. I don't think I'll ever go back to what I was doing at FreeUp, where I was working like 12, 14 hours a day. I was working 7 days a week. I was going to 3 conferences a month. I was going on 3 to 5 podcasts a day. Like I did that. It was great. I would do it over again if I had to. But like now I want to build businesses that I can build a bigger team up front, make it so it's not just me. And I'm happy to like do certain things, go on podcasts. Like we are committed to growing Econ Balance, and Econ Balance is growing, and we have an awesome team, and we're continuing to promote it and work on it and put a lot of time and energy into it. But it's way different than the hustle days of FreeUp.
Okay, good. All right, so last thing here. If you're hiring, you're outsourcing, right? What are your top, you know, 2 or 3 tips for people when hiring, right? You teach these people, you know, you charge for your advice on how to outsource jobs. What are a couple of tips that someone can take away on how to hire people overseas?
Yeah, so when you're interviewing, we have what we call our CARE interview process, which is communication, attitudes, red flags, and experience. So a lot of people do 2 things. They focus on experience, they focus on the skills, and they look for the right answers during interviews. We look for the red flags, the wrong answers, and we want the trifecta of skill, attitude, and communication. We want to know, what is this person saying that shows they won't be able to communicate effectively with me and my team? And what is this person saying that shows they don't have the right attitude to work with me in my company? So we're looking for that trifecta. We don't hire people that have 1 out of 3 or 2 out of 3. And then when we find someone that has all 3 and we want to hire them, before they start, we do what we call the SICK onboarding method, S-I-C-C. And that's schedule, issues, communication, and culture. And we'll sit down with them for 20 to 30 minutes and really set expectations. What are you going to do if you have a power outage? Do you have a backup power outage? Do you have backup internet? Do you have anything in your personal life that's going to interfere with work? Because we don't work with people that one thing happens in their personal life and they can't work for 1 or 2 months. How do they use email? How do they use Slack? What's expected them for phone calls? We want them to know what they're getting into, and we want them to back out if it's not a good fit. We'd much rather they back out than us invest 2 to 3 months into training them only for them to realize the schedule doesn't really work for them or whatever it is. So that's kind of my key that I think will help a lot of entrepreneurs. Obviously, if you want our exact interview questions and stuff, you can go to Outsource School, but make sure you focus on communication, attitude, and experience, and make sure you spend time setting expectations with them before they actually start.
Mm-hmm. And what are these red flags? Like, I mean, of course, some people, it's maybe common sense what a red flag would be, but what are red flags that you've come across even potentially often that you stay away from?
Yeah. So let's say that your business is mostly on Slack. You're not doing a lot of Zoom calls. You're not doing a lot of phone calls with your VAs. I recommend that you do a Slack interview so you can see how they actually handle Slack. And if you're asking a question on Slack and they're taking 5 to 8 minutes to respond to every question, well, guess what? When you get into a meeting, they're going to take a long time to respond to everything, and it's going to take forever to go back and forth. If you can't understand what they're saying, if they're not understanding your questions, if they're not answering your questions directly, that's all under the communication category. But that's just one example of a red flag that would stick out if you know how your company communicates, and during the interview, they're not displaying that they can communicate in the way that you want.
So how do you know Slack interview? This is the first time I heard about this. So you invite them to your Slack or a test Slack or something, and then you say, hey, we're going to have an interview here? Is that like before they've accepted an offer?
Yes. I mean, that's if the role is Slack only. Like if you're hiring someone for a phone call role, you better do the interview via phone call and make sure they're good on phone calls. But I mean, a lot of people, you're 95% of the time you're talking to the VA on Slack. So you better, like, don't do a Zoom interview, do a Slack interview, make sure that they can respond on time on Slack and communicate and speak English and all that stuff in the way that you're going
to communicate. But I'm trying to find out how you do it though. How do you do it? You just tell them, hey, log into my Slack. Here's the invite.
Yeah.
You send the invite. I'm going to ask you questions.
Yeah, we set the expectation up front. Say, hey, this is going to be a 45-minute interview. I'm going to send you answers on Slack. I expect fast responses, and let's do it. And then you go from there and you go back and forth. In Outsource School, we actually have videos of us interviewing VAs on Slack, and it's a very effective process, and it avoids a lot of the you got to remember, a lot of VAs aren't comfortable on Zoom. They're not comfortable on phone calls. So you could miss out on a really great VA who's perfect for what you need and is going to be great on Slack, because you put them on a Zoom call, which has nothing to do with their actual job.
Wow, interesting. Well, that's great info. All right, and so Nathan, if someone wants to hear more about you, right, where should they go? Where do they find out if they want to learn more about outsourcing or they want to handle their books for e-commerce or not e-commerce? Where are they going to find you?
Yeah, so first of all, connect with me on LinkedIn, Nathan Hirsch. Feel free to shoot me a message. Love connecting with other entrepreneurs. You can go to Econ Balance, get 2 months free of bookkeeping if you mention this podcast. Go to Outsource School. You can actually schedule an appointment with my all-star VA. She'll hook you up there. You can mention this podcast for a 30% discount. So yeah, appreciate you having me on, and I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Awesome, brother. Good having you, man. Peace.
See ya.